This is CHUO 89.1 FM. Welcome to this week's episode of The Mosaic, your weekly show highlighting the voices of the community. Here, we guide you through today's social issues, introduce you to changemakers, and keep in touch with the arts, music, and events of the city. You can expect extensive research, in-depth analysis, and discussion. From CHUO's news team, this is The Mosaic. Today, a closer look at human trafficking in Canada. We speak with documentarian Viveka Melky about her film, Trafficked Voices, as it shares the stories of survivors.
It's really terrible. What's terrible is that it's still happening. I think I've gone past shock and terrible into what are we doing about it?
Then we look ahead to the Ottawa Black Film Festival as it kicks off this weekend. And finally, we'll hear from James Brennan about how a country can rebrand itself, hiding its own points of skew.
The words gross national happiness were never used in public to address the Bhutanese people. According to my own research, which I did years later, during the 1980s, the only documented cases of the king using gross national happiness was when he was talking to foreigners.
Stick around. I'm Lauren Rolston, and we've got all that and more coming up on The Mosaic. Human trafficking doesn't have to involve crossing borders. In fact, a great majority of it involves staying within Canada. Statistics Canada also shows that most victims of human trafficking are women and girls. Trafficked Voices is a documentary on CBC Gem, where three survivors share their stories. It's the first of a three-part film series aimed at addressing this national crisis. I spoke with filmmaker Viveka Melky about her research, her work with these survivors, and the conversations that need to be had around human trafficking. Here's that conversation. The last time we spoke, we were talking about your historical documentary, The Fence, and today we're talking about Trafficked Voices, which is a huge and shocking account of human trafficking in Canada. I want to start our conversation by understanding what opened your eyes to the issue of human trafficking and as a subject that you'd end up researching.
Like most people, it was right in front of me. And I, like most Canadians, was walking around not realizing that. I was working with one of our Indigenous Grandmother Circle members and heard about stories of a young woman who ended up being sexually abused, and to make a long story short, thought that this was an accident, thought it was something that had just happened by chance, and it ends up being that she was actually sold multiple times online. And so that is how it started for me, and I started doing research. We've been doing research now for going on to 4 years on this subject. And to be clear, all of our films are on domestic sexual human trafficking in Canada. So folks think that this is something coming from outside. In fact, we're talking about something that's right here within our borders.
Yeah, I remember reading some crazy statistic, in fact, 93% of human trafficking is happening within Canada. It's not imported.
Yes, exactly. And when I said, I mentioned multiple films. Let me say that we are making three films on this subject, which is rare. The first one, Trafficked Voices, which you mentioned, has already come out with the CBC on The Passionate Eye. And the second one we're making is with TELUS, which will be streaming onto the TELUS platform nationally. And it is around BC and Alberta, human trafficking. And the third one is called La Plaque Tournante, and it is for Radio-Canada. It comes out in the fall, and it is on trafficking specifically around Quebec and the Francophone issues with trafficking also.
Mm-hmm. I know this is kind of a huge question, but what have you noticed difference-wise between these demographics of these three different films? How is it different within Canada, human trafficking?
That's a really good question, and I hate to tell you, but it's very similar. In fact, this is exactly why we need three films to tell us that this is a national issue that needs to be addressed at a federal level without the provincial jurisdiction and borders that's occurring, whether it's in law enforcement or legal. It needs to be addressed federally. For example, in Trafficked Voices, the wonderful Kelly Beale, who is in the film. There should be a Kelly Beale for every province, and there isn't. And so I believe that there are moves occurring for that out of British Columbia, but Ontario is the only person who has a Kelly Beale. And things like that would facilitate the work and the prevention and the support of those who are in the anti-human trafficking movement, because there's a lot of silos going on, and that is an issue. That could be, and I'm not a lawmaker, so that could be a legislative issue. But that's not something that's helping the situation. But the biggest thing that is across three films is we must prevent. Curing is difficult, expensive, a huge trauma. I don't even have the words. Huge trauma to the survivors. And so we must talk about prevention for this issue.
And so, in light of that prevention, we need a little bit more work from federal and provincial governments. What can you tell me about federal and provincial governments' current stance towards human trafficking?
There is funding dedicated to this. I cannot answer for what's happening inside the walls, but I can say that there are many organizations that are working on the ground to support. As I said, there are many levels of amazing people that we met working in, whether it's shelters or housing, or whether it's frontline police officers. There's a lot of people who are working to better understand this issue. And that's what we hope the Trafficked Voices did. We have had feedback since the film came out that it has done that, that folks who watch it understand, not only from whether you're a parent or you have a sister in life, whether you are, we've heard that those in the field have appreciated having a tool that could help them explain this, because it's very hard to understand. The psychology behind it is hard to understand. And the brave survivors who came into our films and helped us understand this, it's really moved the conversation, which is amazing.
And I want to talk more about those voices that have helped move the conversation too. But first, I want to talk about how like anybody can be trafficked. But based on what I've read and the research that you've done, average age of the victims can be quite young. So can you tell me more about what you've found out about this group of people?
Yeah, that I think that was shocking to me and to my team. Stats vary between 14, 16, definitely under 18. Our film and our research firsthand found 14 to be the average age. You're talking about, wow, what a beautiful age, right? The age of vulnerability, the age of sexuality, the age of becoming. It's an amazing time. And that we found was the average that we were seeing. It's very sad for me to say that because it's terrible. And I have spoken in schools, which I like to do. I have spoken in schools around the film since then. And I'm looking at a room of wonderful youth who have no idea that they are being targeted through so many of the social media platforms. And the shock on their faces when I told them that Snapchat is the number one entry point for traffickers to contact youth. So that if we can just keep doing that, if we can invest in education, if we can just inform them, because for those of us that are parents or those of us that know young people or were young people, right? We were all there. We knew that we never thought of those dangers. And so it's really a skilled manipulation of that age group who would never think of this, you
Yeah.
know?
And I think
So.
like that vulnerability, it's like a key word to answering the why these ages are being targeted too. But it's interesting because there are parents who might not know how to address conversations when it comes to social media platforms because it seems like the models of human trafficking are always evolving to see how they can get to this demographic. That
Yes.
shocks me that Snapchat was the main way. Can you tell me more
Yeah.
about how you found
Yeah.
that out?
Well, because you're making friends, right? You're making friends and you're sending photos and things disappear, but they don't disappear. We've seen that the online luring and grooming is very heavily on send me photos of yourself for and then using that for bribery. We've seen that it becomes it's basically waits for someone's vulnerability, whether it's I fought with my mom or you know, it's not even as big as my parents are getting divorced. It's like, I fought with my mom and I hate her. Like it's just basic stuff that causes an entry point. We also, not to say that it's only there, luring and grooming is occurring at anywhere from the local gym to youth center to it's happening everywhere. And it's about educating our youth in what is a healthy relationship and what is consent. These are big things, but very much what love is and what healthy is and what somebody can ask you to do or not do if they're in a relationship with you. And just making them aware that these platforms are not, they're porous. Because you said something just now, and I love this phrase that we learned along our journey, which was trafficking is like water. It moves to the place of least resistance. And that's the thing. It changes so quickly. And so we who are in anti-human trafficking are trying to keep up. So the thing we have to do is just teach our kids, and they're very receptive. The classrooms I spoke to are very receptive. There's just really this shock on their face that they did not think that that person on social media is not who they say they are, or very high levels also, if it's female who is luring for someone else. That's the other one that we don't talk about a lot. It's the unexpected. So just really understanding that someone who wants to be your friend, because we're in the, oh, I've got friends. Yeah, but just have to be careful if you haven't really met that person or you don't really know their circle, or, we live in a world where they want 700 friends on Snapchat, but do they really know who those people are? And do they really know who, what's being asked?
Yeah, wow. And it could happen anywhere at any time to anyone, pretty
It really
much.
can. And I want to say something that is like, we obviously have the stats that unfortunately 52% around of human trafficking events can be occurring in Indigenous communities or can be occurring to members who are of BIPOC communities. But I don't want that to make it an excuse for us to look away and say, oh, it's not my kid. Oh, it can't be my neighborhood. This is happening in every town and city across this country, every single town. So don't ever think that it's not happening close to you or it can't happen to your kid because they don't fit some demographic. That would be a mistake because it is happening to all peoples in this country. And it's really, really very, very serious.
And I think something that you captured really well in Trafficked Voices is this sense of how close to home it is, because you're in the houses of, a mother who was so worried about her daughter, and it becomes that much more real. It's close to home, but it also feels like it's huge and a little out of reach.
It feels surreal. Like you're just like, this can't be happening. This can't have happened to my friend's kid. I mean, I think one of the most moving parts for me was Brenda, who was the mother in our film, whose daughter was trafficked, and how fast it happened. It was actually, it was again luring online through Facebook very quickly through a female contact. Very quickly, she ends up in Toronto, and she ends up trafficked for a short period of time. Now, let's not underestimate what I'm saying there. A short period of time is 24 hours out of a hotel room. You're talking about back-to-back clients, and you're talking about a couple of thousand dollars being made. So this isn't small. This isn't small potatoes here. We're talking about sort of an average victim bringing in, 350 to 400,000 at least per victim. So it's a lot of money. This is not small business. I think people really need to, understand how much money is being made here.
Right, the traffickers make so much money, and the victims often see none of it. And
They see none of it. And then oftentimes, which is one aspect in this particular film, is that they come out with debt. They come out with credit card debt, with hotel rooms that have been charged to them, with their identity stolen, with the inability to rent an apartment after that, to have a job. They don't have bank accounts. That's what fascinated me, was also the long-term damage that was occurring to them that was not being discussed. We're not thinking of after, oh, well, they're out. No, well, they're also, my God, they're dealing with car loans that are in their names that they still have to answer for.
Which is another method of trying to keep them in the system too, another piece of blackmail that can be used.
Right. I have to say, to be positive, since the film, we've had a really interesting reaction from corporate, from banks, and from companies who are trying to become more aware. Because if you're a car company, If you're a bank, if you're a Visa, maybe you didn't know. And it's all about employee training. And I am hopeful about that. I'm hopeful because in the end, yes, it's fraud, but in the end, you're also, thank God, helping these survivors because they can't explain to you. What do you mean? I took the card. No, you didn't. I took the student loan. No, it wasn't me. These are things that I just hoped are better understood after the film.
Yeah, it's all part of advancing that conversation forward, like you said. And it's interesting to see that that can reach corporate too, which can have greater impacts.
Yep, it really can. And I say we have power by our purchase. And I think that is exactly what I'm saying is I hope that and I know that some corporations have stepped up and said, okay, what's our role? How can we help? How can we start to see this and train our staff to see it?
So that's been one of the reactions you've had since the film. What else have you heard so far?
We've had a number of survivors reach out to us and say thank you for making the film and that this was part of their story, and I really appreciate that. We, as I said, the education part is we're hoping that the film continues to be used in schools and to educate. It needs support around that. It's not an easy film to watch. And I want to say that there is a policy at Melki Films, which we call our ethical storytelling policy. And any time that that film is seen, something goes back to the survivors who were in the film. That's really important for us. They had an immense courage in coming forward to tell their story, and we hope to help improve their lives. We don't just make a film on people and then leave. That's not what we're trying to do. We hope that us being part of your story meant that you moved your dial, that you were able to either go back to school or have housing or just get through every day a little bit easier. That's what we hope. So the film has been nominated in a few festivals. It won Best Documentary at the LA Women in Film, which is great. And again, for me, it's just more people, it's really about people becoming aware of this. That's what, it helps the conversation. That's what I'm glad for.
And that ethical storytelling is such an important foundation to be able to share those stories. And I want to talk about one specific survivor in the film. I was so shocked to hear that Jeannie was being trafficked in these cargo ships on the Great Lakes. That was mind-blowing to me. What were some of the things that shocked you when you were researching for this?
Well, I have to give credit where it's due. There is a researcher out of the United States who had written a long time ago about this. You ask any indigenous community, and they will tell you they know this is happening. Thunder Bay, we know it's still happening. Jeannie was incredibly brave to come forward and then to come into the light, as we call it, which was a decision she made at some point during the filming. But I was blown away it was happening. Just blew me away. We have heard of this in international waters, but that it's happening right out of Canadian waters is really something. So I don't have words for her courage. I think I will be haunted by her interview for the rest of my life. It was really, it's really terrible. What's terrible is that it's still happening. I think I've gone past shock and terrible into what are we doing about it? What are we going to do about that? We know it's happening. So, we know it's happening outside work camps. We know it's happening. It's not just happening at big events like Formula One. It's happening at any major event. It's happening in Ottawa downtown. So, I mean, what shocks me is as a society, how we are all part of it. And I'm not talking about purchasing someone who's being trafficked. I'm talking about clean water in Inuit communities of the north. I'm talking about shelter, enough shelter for people who are exiting. We are all part of this. We need to look at poverty and the price of living and the cost of life. We need to look at that. And then we're looking at fixing trafficking because it is the same. It can happen to anyone, and it happens because life is very expensive. And across the film, you see that there is no judgment of choices that people make. And for me, there's no judgment. That includes sex work. I don't have judgment there. What I'm trying to say, though, is the society has to hold itself responsible as a whole.
Addressing those systemic issues
That's
as a means
right.
of prevention, like you said
That's
earlier.
right. Exactly.
I remember another thing that Jeannie said in the film is that she was billed when she got back to Canada, and there were no further questions.
Yes, we are working on that. Yeah, I haven't heard from Global Affairs that that's been changed. Come back to me in 6 months and I'll see. We still have to, you know, that is that seriously. I haven't heard anything. I'd love to know if something happened with that. But I'll tell you what, I will follow up on it.
Thank you. Yeah.
Because I believe that's still happening also.
Wow. And then that moment where she stepped into the light, it was like a moment in the film that kind of gave me the like, oh, this is what we talked about with the fence, where that storytelling, giving someone a platform where they can be comfortable to heal, to move forward with this story. And seeing that was so incredible and must have been so hard for her. What was that like for you as a filmmaker as well in that room?
That was not easy. That's not easy for her till this day. And we tried to provide the support during the making of the film as much as we could. For that, what was it like? I was blown away that she decided to do it, at her courage. My God, it was so much about what this is about, which is coming out of the shadows and into the light and claiming it, because it's almost like we don't believe it otherwise. I called Jeannie. It's funny, it's tattooed on her hand, but I call Jeannie the Queen. She's amazing. It was like looking at a queen on her throne, frankly. And she's just this amazing person. Mm-hmm. And her voice is amazing too. I know you work in the world of voice. She has such a strong, powerful voice. So yeah, it was incredible, unexpected. And I just want her to always know that we appreciated that and that it has changed things for people. I think it's clear that the survivors in this film came forward or discussed their story or their family's story because they want to prevent it for someone else. That's what they're doing. They're trying to say, please listen, this can happen and you've got to watch out and you've got to be careful. So incredible courage. And this film was hard because we filmed through the pandemic, right? This was a pandemic film, which is how you see that a lot of people are alone, but not together. It was very difficult to do. And I remember we were filming in deserted cities. There was nobody anywhere. It was very, very eerie sort of feeling making this film.
Wow. And then, I want to take it back to these survivors because they have such powerful voices. And I remember hearing from another one, Augusta. She was, I remember the term, Romeo'd by a pimp. But for people who might not be familiar, could you explain a little bit about Romeo and maybe some of the other ways that victims are lured?
Yes, one of the most common forms, I think. Romeoing is when somebody falls in love with you. You make somebody fall in love with you through a careful study of what they need in life, through a careful study of their vulnerabilities and of what they want. And if that could be a white picket fence, it could be education, it could be I can't pay university, it could be I've had a lonely childhood and I need love, it could be anything. But the person falls in love with an individual, and very quickly, between 3 to 6 weeks, even up to 6 weeks, can start being trafficked. It can start very simply with, I need money, baby. Can you help me? You know, I know you love me. It's just going to be this time. And it ends up being multiple times. We're going to share the money. And then there's no money. And quickly, the person is being trafficked multiple times a day. It can move from Romeo, what we call Romeoing, into guerrilla, which is fear. I'm going to hurt your family. I'm going to kill your dog, everything. It can go very quickly. But Romeoing for me happens a lot with young people, happens a lot with that teenage group who has, as I said, I think I said earlier, we have to teach healthy relationships. And Lauren, I'm going to say something quite bold, which is we have to look at early childhood. We have to look at childhood. And where kids are growing up, if they're growing up in care, what is the support? What's the psychological support? Because it's all starting young. And if we don't fix young, then we are creating more vulnerable teens. It's not just starting suddenly you're 13 and you're, you know, if it's coming from somewhere else. And so those in care, we know in our second film, we're talking about that. Those who are in care are more vulnerable too. So we have to go way back, you know, to see where this is starting. But that's what Romeoing is, and that's what happened to Augusta. Yeah.
Very manipulative. And do we know about like how these methods of trafficking have, we touched on it a little bit earlier, but how they've evolved over time with, say, the advances of technology and social media? I'm also thinking specifically about like a rise in sugar daddies.
Yeah, I mean, Lauren, let's talk about a rise in the cost of education, right? If you're trying to pay for your university and you're holding down three jobs while trying to go to school, has anyone seen their grocery bill lately? Like, let's talk about those costs. And then how about if somebody's sick at home and and all the money is going to help them? There's all these things that I was saying that make a fractured and a fragile society. And so, yes, has there been a change? Well, most movement across the country happens in vehicles. Vehicles are a big mover, but airports, buses. So the transport is happening in all kinds of ways. What's changed is the online component. That is like, imagine one giant gateway that's open, and then you're saying, hey, come in. So it's basically that's the big gateway. This is no longer happening, as I said, at a bar or a, yes, it's happening on university campuses. Kelly, I think, mentions it. It's huge on campuses. You have sometimes traffickers who go and sit in classrooms and pretend to be students until a girl falls in love or a boy. Let's not forget that this is happening to men and boys too, and it's happening to LGBTQ2 communities a lot. So it's happening. But again, yes, it's happening on campus. The student loan one shocked me most of all. Wow. Student loans being taken out. And so, yeah, I would say that the online component is the biggest highway that has opened, that we are not even close. And you know, Lauren, it makes me angry because why isn't our government protecting us a little bit more? Or why isn't someone protecting our kids a little bit more? Because every parent will say, you know, every parent goes through it, right? The social media nightmare, keeping them off their phones. But we need to really understand the cost of this if we don't actually do some kind of protection.
So those were all the questions that I had for you today. Did you have anything else that you wanted to add?
I want to say that I will keep talking about this until our kids are safe. I just can't. You know, for me to dedicate 5 years of my life to this subject, and you and I met on a film called The Fence, where we talked about women in camps for 14 hours a day being sexually assaulted. This is happening off the 401 highway. So before we look to other societies for that, we need to look to ourselves. We need to ask ourselves some hard questions about the commodification of humans in our own country. And but what I want to say is thank you for asking me these questions today. And to parents and everyone, don't be afraid. Watch the film and talk to your kids. If you can't show the film to your kids because it's 14 plus, at least talk to them. But if you can't talk about sex to your kids, you can't talk about trafficking. So you have to actually bring those two things in together so that you can have an open conversation. Because if they're not talking to you, they'll talk to someone. So it better be you, right? And I said this to a classroom, which was quite shocking. I said, you need to teach the kids the value. You need to teach your kids their value in life, or somebody else will teach them their value. And you better put a price on that. You have to teach them their immense value as a person so that they don't go seeking that validation somewhere else.
Spreading awareness in the youth, spreading self-confidence in the youth, but also trying to combat these crises that we're facing, like the cost of living.
Absolutely. Because this isn't just about buying and selling somebody. This is not just about sex. It's about something far more complex, I think, that's harder for us to do an ad campaign around. It's harder to admit what's happening in our own country with poverty.
A hard conversation, but it's got to be had.
That's right.
Well,
Thank you for having it.
thank you so much for being on the show again. I really
It's
appreciate
a
it.
pleasure, Lauren. Thank you.
That was my conversation with filmmaker Viveka Malki on her documentary, Trafficked Voices, available on CBC Gem. The fourth Ottawa Black Film Festival is starting up this weekend. The festival will be showcasing short films, documentaries, and authentic Black stories in a hybrid model to amplify the voices of Afro-descendants. The festival has over 40 film screenings lined up, showcasing Black narratives from around the world. Some of the films lined up come from the UK, Central African Republic, Italy, and Germany. These stories of Black immigrants, excellence, and creativity also come in a multitude of different languages, from French to Sango to German and Yoruba. And many of these films belong to the festival series called Being Black in Canada, which aims to support Black Canadian filmmakers. The festival opens up tomorrow with a film called Talia's Journey. At Library and Archives Canada, attendees will see the story of a 19-year-old Belgian girl with Senegalese roots, as she visits her country of origin for the first time. Talia's Journey by Christophe Rollin is screening at 7 p.m. tomorrow. Then, 8 events are set in place for the next day of the festival on Saturday. Screenings, discussions, and Q&As are lined up again at Library and Archives Canada from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. The festival wraps up with remote screenings and workshops on Sunday. For more information and tickets for these screenings and events, head to ottawablackfilm.com. And now, CHUO's James Brennan returns with his segment, Point of Skew. Here, he typically analyzes points of bias in media coverage and its foundations. But today, he's taking an even wider look at skews and slants and looking into how a country can brand itself in a positive light and conceal the diverse issues of its population. Here to shed more light on Bhutan, a country of under a million people that's been called the world's happiest country, is James Brennan.
Hello, and welcome back to Point of Skew. I'm James Brennan, and today we'll have a new kind of episode. I'm currently taking an International Development and Communications course at UOttawa this semester. It covers topics of how communication, and more specifically how information and communications technology, or ICTs, have the ability to develop areas through the spread of information. With all the models and theories of any fourth-year course, it's gotten quite intricate, but the concept of how powerful effective information is has really struck a chord with me. The structure of this course has it that every week we have one guest lecture come in and discuss one of the topics that we're looking at that week. Earlier in the semester, we have one of UOttawa's own professors, Professor Lachlan Monroe, come into class. He brought up a topic that I thought would be a perfect fit for this show. When we typically discuss different countries around the world, we talk about a number of aspects surrounding their economy, culture, or political climate. Yet, Professor Monroe brought up the country of Bhutan and their story of gross national happiness. At face value, what does this sound like? Maybe a political incentive to ensure that citizens in Bhutan are happy? Or possibly that conventional life for residents of Bhutan prioritizes aspects that would improve their day-to-day lives? Through Professor Monroe's guest lecture, we come to understand that this couldn't be further from the truth. Bhutan's gross national happiness would be seen as a shining example of how to foster development by meeting individual needs of citizens. But actually, the truth is much darker. It involves a small, landlocked nation caught between two growing powers, quietly establishing a cultural monopoly that saw 1/6 of their population expelled in a matter of years. Thank you for coming on, Mr. Monroe.
My pleasure, James.
So, I'll hand it over to you and tell us your story.
My story in relation to Bhutan?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, as a relatively young man, I was lucky to get a job as a WUSC, World University Service of Canada volunteer in Bhutan, from June 1985 to June 1987. I taught at Shorobtsi College, which was the only secondary school and undergraduate college in the country. I was one half of the economics department there. So yeah, I had a great time there. I taught Introduction to Economics, and I taught a course called Indian Economics, which was basically about the Indian economy. So I taught those two courses. I was the warden of a hostel. In other words, I was in charge of a student residence for about, 100 or more students in that residence, in addition to all the usual administrative duties that teachers and lecturers have in a college. So there. And then, so that's how I got to Bhutan.
And so what was your experience with the government and the policy of gross national happiness?
Well, gross national happiness wasn't the policy at that time. In fact, I only heard the word once. And that was after the king was interviewed in the Financial Times, a British newspaper. He was interviewed in early April 1987. And one of the lecturers, we had a visiting lecturer from the City University of Hong Kong, I think, who came and who caused quite a bit of controversy, but that's another story. Anyways, one of the Bhutanese lecturers, Thakur Singh Podyal, challenged him and mentioned the king's pronouncement on gross national happiness. And that was the first time in almost 2 years in the country I'd heard of it. And if you go through all the documents produced by the government at that time, gross national happiness is never mentioned there. Government was very clear that they wanted to pursue their own development path, that it was different. And that was very clear. But the words gross national happiness were never used in public to address the Bhutanese people. According to my own research, which I did years later, during the 1980s, the only documented cases of the king using gross national happiness was when he was talking to foreigners.
Interesting.
And he used this phrase that gross national happiness is more important than gross national product, which was, you know, a very clever play on words, a very nifty communication tool. So, you know, hats off to him for inventing that phrase. It certainly sounded convincing. But it was, you know, at best at the time, it was something that the king used when talking to foreigners. It was not something that appeared in any official government document at the time. And it was used as a sort of post hoc justification for the decision long made, which was to pursue a form of development that was going to be different. You know, Bhutan had seen the downside of mass tourism in Nepal and Afghanistan starting in the 1960s. So Bhutan restricted the number of tourists and insisted that they pay loads of money. So they got high-end tourists in Bhutan, whereas Nepal got backpackers and all that went with that. And the government was very insistent that the Buddhist character of the country and the culture be preserved through the process of development.
And on that point, can you talk a little bit about the cultural landscape of Bhutan?
Well, Bhutan is, like most countries, a pretty plural place. You know, there's 11 odd languages, you know, Bumthap, Tibetan, Dzongkha, Nepali, Sharshapka, and on. There are three main religions, the Drukpa branch of the Kagyupa division of Mahayana Buddhism. There was a large Hindu population of Nepali origin, especially living in the southern part of Bhutan along the Indian border. And in parts of the mountain periphery, there are people who practice the Bon religion, which arguably is a form of Buddhism, but I won't get into that. All this to say that, you know, it was a very culturally, linguistically, and religiously plural society. But the government was Dzongkha speaking, and Dzongkha is the language of half a dozen valleys in the west of the country. They were ethnic Drukpas, who had a particular type of dress, which was common across different language groups in eastern, central, and western Bhutan. And they were the Drukpa branch of the Kagyupa division of Mahayana Buddhism. So they took their culture and language as the national language and the national culture. So Dzongkha is a language that, unless you went to school, nobody in central and eastern Bhutan would understand. It's just completely different from the local languages. So someone from western Bhutan looked a lot and dressed a lot like the people from central and eastern Bhutan, but they couldn't speak to each other, unless they spoke Dzongkha or another common language like English or perhaps Nepali.
Okay, and what is the political climate of the area? Because I know that Bhutan is between India and China, and there's some border disputes as well.
Well, yeah. So Bhutan has the geographical position of being stuck between two of the biggest countries on earth, India
and
China. And they have, you know, all the classic problems that buffer states have. Mm-hmm. They have to manage the neighbors, right? And they have no power. They don't, you know, Bhutan is never going to be a military power that's capable of challenging either India or Bhutan. This situation has gone on for, you know, hundreds of years. But the understanding has always been that Bhutan is part of India's security perimeter. Okay? And since 1950, when China occupied Tibet, the Indian government's position has been that their security perimeter is the high Himalayan range, which means basically the border between Bhutan and China. Or in Nepal's case, the border between Nepal and China. So the, you know, the unspoken bargain, and sometimes it's actually been spoken by Indian politicians and Indian officials, is that, you know, run your own country the way you like, but the minute you become a security threat to India, the minute that it looks like there could be Chinese penetration of India's security perimeter on the high Himalayan range, then it becomes India's business. And so when Sikkim, which had also been a smaller but independent country, where the king was a Buddhist and tried to enforce a Buddhist character on his country against a population that was majority non-Buddhist, he failed, there were riots, and India just said, no, this is a threat to our security, and India just sent the army in. The Indian army took over Sikkim in a matter of days, and India annexed Sikkim, and that was the end of Sikkim as an independent state. So the Bhutanese are very afraid of following the Sikkim example. The royal family of Sikkim was related to the royal family of Bhutan. So the Bhutanese government has been very careful to do everything to keep on India's right side when it comes to maintaining security.
Interesting. And in my research, I noticed that in the early 1990s or during the 1990s, there was a bit of a cultural shift in the sense that 1/6 of the population was forced out due to a change in policy. Can you touch on that a little bit?
It goes back to the mid-1980s, and Bhutan was changing rapidly. The economy was growing. You know, roads had been driven into the interior, 3 north-south roads and an east-west road tying the country together for the first time. Lots of foreign workers built those roads with Indian government funding. More Bhutanese got literate in English, especially, and things like videos from India and from the West started coming in, and music, cassette tapes came in. And so when I taught there, I had a number of students who were expert at breakdancing, you know, doing the Michael Jackson moonwalk, and they knew all the latest Western pop music. And, you know, one of these kids was, his father was the secretary of the commission in charge of preserving the national culture. So there was a lot of fear in the government that they were modernizing the economy but losing their culture. So the government started cracking down, and it insisted that Bhutanese could not visit the Dzong, the administrative and religious center of every district, without wearing Bhutanese dress. You couldn't walk in dressed in a shirt and tie or a t-shirt. They insisted that people in urban areas wear national dress. Again, this is the Drukpa dress. This is not the national dress of the Nepali minority.
The most prevalent cultures.
Yeah. So they started cracking down, and the government stopped the teaching of the Nepali language in schools in the south of Bhutan along the Indian border. So the Nepali-speaking population, who were probably at least a third of the population by then, probably 40%. Nobody did a proper census. Or at least there was a census, but the results were never published, mm-hmm. and rumors circulated as a result. But, you know, some people said the Nepalis were actually the majority of the population. Anyways, those Nepali-speaking Hindus living on the southern border started resisting this imposition of what to them was a foreign culture and a foreign language, and the erosion of their right to be taught in their own language in school and such. So there was some pushback. There were some borderline violent confrontations. One district commissioner was stripped naked and paraded through the streets, which is, you know, like in most countries, that would be an enormous mm-hmm. cultural faux pas. So then the royal government of Bhutan cracked down, and they kicked out over 100,000 people of Nepali descent who the government claims were illegal immigrants, and but whom the international community, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, for refugees has recognized as legitimate refugees, that is, people suffering from a well-founded fear of persecution in their country. I mean, you know, if you get pushed out of your house in the middle of the night and then the government says, and shipped off to a foreign country, and your house gets burned down, and then the government says, well, where's the paperwork proving that you were legitimate here in the first place? And they, well, I left it in that house you stole from me. Well, prove it, you know, is what the government. So the Bhutanese government stonewalled and said, well, if these people can't produce paperwork, we have to assume they're illegal and we have the right to kick them out. But they were kicked out with enormous violence. There were murders, there was torture, there was rape, all the usual things that happen when ethnic cleansing happens.
And this was all in efforts to preserve the most prevalent or the ruling family's culture, essentially.
Yes. Yeah.
And do you think there's a link between these events and kind of the outward-facing narrative of gross national happiness?
Well, as I say, the outward-facing narrative of gross national happiness had started about a decade earlier. I found two interviews with the New York Times journalist from 1980 when the King talks about these things, and another with the Financial Times in 1987, and then one or two mentions in other places. But again, gross national happiness was something that the King used when he talked to foreigners, not when he talked to Bhutanese. What changed in the 1990s, after Bhutan started getting this bad publicity over the ethnic cleansing, was in addition to amping up this discourse about, oh, a separate, distinct development path, they started amping up the talk about gross national happiness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, gross national happiness has been, it's a very malleable concept. If you look at the very first versions of it that the Royal Government of Bhutan trotted out, they sound a lot like the Human Development and Capabilities Network work of, you know, Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum and the UN Development Program's Human Development Index. Later versions talk about environmental preservation and good governance, using all the, you know, the good buzzwords.
Methods of skew.
Of the development industry. Well, there's your skew. But then they added this thing that one of the core pillars, one of the core tenets of gross national happiness is preserving the national culture.
Hmm.
Well, you know, my question is, which national culture? Whose national
exactly.
culture? Because this is a plural
multicultural
society,
area.
Multicultural, multilinguistic, multi-ethnic, multi-religious society. So when you preserve the national culture, it's someone's culture, language, form of dress, to the detriment of others.
Mm-hmm. And in my research, as well as your guest lecture, you mentioned how this gross national happiness has kind of created a lot of tourism buzz for Bhutan as well.
Oh yeah, it's been, it's been great for attracting certain types of people in the Western world to the Bhutanese cause. So, you know, all the New Agers, you know, all the yoga teaching, New Age types, they love it because of, oh, it's the essence is Buddhist and Buddhism is a peaceful religion, and they give you all these sorts of lines, and you know, Buddhism at its best is a peaceful religion, so is Christianity, but so is Islam, but name me a religion and I'll name you an atrocity that's been committed in its name. You know, all religions can be and have been abused, and Buddhism is no exception to that rule. The New Age crowd loved it for its alleged Buddhist leanings, for the idea that it valued some kind of spiritual end to development over material ends to development. The environmentalist movement grabbed onto this because of the commitment to clean environment and greener forms of development and forms of development that didn't rely on, you know, mass and crass consumption. So you can see why the deep ecology people would love this as well. And, you know, of course, the high-end tourists who are ready, willing, and able to spend literally hundreds of dollars on a hotel room, who, you know, are going to go to a country and probably not do a lot of deep political and historical research. You know, this is a good selling point. This is a niche tourism market that they're willing to exploit. mm-hmm. and that the Bhutanese have very adeptly and very intelligently exploited.
Essentially, it's a bit of a situation of a Band-Aid on a broken dam kind of thing, where you have the history of this cultural genocide and the wiping out, or the mass exodus of 1/6 of the population, rather. And then you kind of see it warped or changed through smart communication skills or skew to this gross national happiness tourism boom, essentially.
You said it. You said it, yeah. No, it's become a very good marketing tool. And of course, the groups that I mentioned, you know, the deep ecologists, the New Age yoga people, they and the high-end wealthy tourists, they overlap. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's been a good marketing strategy for them.
Well, thank you for sitting down with me and talking about Bhutan and your experiences there. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Another thank you to Professor Monroe for sitting down and sharing his experience, but also laying out how the Bhutanese government has used careful communication skills and methods askew to subvert and cover up public opinion. The violent exodus of more than 1/6 of a country's population is something that would absolutely affect their public image. However, with careful use of gross national happiness from the king when discussing internal affairs with foreigners, is something to examine. I thought this would be a good segment to include on this show, and it's something that I'd want to see grow and develop. By covering larger topics of how skew is present in many different aspects of life, we can start to really see the power of wording, and just how an author can dictate how a story is seen. I'm hoping to continue with this more broad coverage of skew, but still primarily focusing on news and global affairs. I've always thought that it's important to understand how the world has come to what it is, and through the study of these more or less hidden topics, that a more complete and balanced worldview can be achieved. I have plans for this show, and I hope to be able to keep these topics going. I really hope that the people listening to this show are finding it entertaining and interesting. This is a promise, and this has been and will continue to be your call to check the point of skew. I'm James Brennan, and thank you for listening.
And that's it for this week's episode of The Mosaic. Thanks so much for tuning in. Music for The Mosaic is by Helizna. To listen to this episode and previous ones, go to chuo.fm/podcasts. If you're interested in joining our news team, email news@chuo.fm. We'll see you next week, Thursday at 1 p.m.